Monster Man, Special Episode, Spell Weaver. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, Patreon backer Gerald. If you'd like to be like Gerald and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is coming up on its 100th episode and currently in the middle of a season about Egyptian mythology. So it's all about using religion and mythology in your role-playing games through the lens of the Deities and Demigods book. I've gotta come up with a better short description for that show. Anyway, Gerald, thank you very much for your support. It means a lot to me, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. Gerald has asked me to talk about the Spellweaver. Now, when I began reading up on the Spellweaver, I thought to myself, this sounds very familiar. And in fact, we have actually covered the Spellweaver already. But first, we covered it very briefly. I mean, I think for about 3 or 4 minutes. And second, we did it in a patron-exclusive episode, so I think that most listeners won't even have heard that. So, let's start from scratch, assuming that we know nothing about Spellweavers. Spellweavers first appear in a Dragon's Bestiary article in Dragon Magazine number 163, written by Ed O'Connell. So this is like 1990. They are a race of six-armed, telepathic, silent magic experts, and the article mainly focuses on the numerous mechanics of their magical powers and gives them a set of behaviors that discourages but doesn't completely rule out any kind of role-playing or really any kind of thinking. Spellweavers are very focused on obtaining magic items. They will do things like, you know, go to a location, turn invisible, and wait for ages. You know, they'll use their teleportation and other spells to, like, get past guards. They are very magically powerful, and they're very violent and aggressive when they want a magic item. They're described as attacking with, I think, hellish ferocity. They have a unique type of magic item called a chromatic disc that they can store magical energy in so they can cast more spells. Essentially, they have kind of a spell point mechanical system where, you know, they have spell points which they can spend to cast spells of a certain level, you know, rather than a specified number of memorized spells. So they have a much more flexible approach to spell casting. They can also cast multiple spells at a time using only somatic components, right? So they have six hands, so they can cast up to six levels worth of spells. So they could cast 3 second-level spells or a fourth and a second. I mean, you get the picture. They're very, like, weird and arcane. People who try to read their minds might go crazy. They sometimes do communicate with humans in writing, but those writings are kind of cryptic and enigmatic, and no one knows why they want these magic items, because it'd be like the arcane, you know, we don't see the Spellweavers doing anything else with them, right? It's not like Spellweavers steal magic items and then later on they sell them, or it's not like Spellweavers steal magic items and then later on they, you know, return and use them to do something. They just seem to like magic items. I was pretty down on these guys, you know, when we covered this episode of Dragon Magazine. I'm on record as thinking that Dragon was often a victim of the need to fill so many pages every month. When you have to constantly come up with this kind of limitless number of articles, they can't all be winners. And the Spellweaver is exactly the kind of monster that could be designed to miss me, right? Like, it's mechanically complex and interesting, but that's not really what appeals to me. And it doesn't have a compelling narrative hook. Indeed, it seems like its background is written so as to wall off any kind of further interaction. I forget who wrote this criticism, but ironically, as NPCs began to become more fleshed out in RPGs and get, like, more detail to their backstories and whatever, published adventures begin to also tend more toward the railroady, and so therefore a lot of the time what you get in published scenarios is monsters or characters that have detailed but inaccessible backgrounds, right? A lengthy psychological justification for why it is plausible that this person does not want to talk to you or interact with you. Which feels a little bit like missing the point. But when the players can talk to NPCs and present arguments and wheedle and bribe or blackmail or bully, then the carefully planned structure of the adventure goes out the window. And so the Spellweaver as written is a monster where it's like, by gum, you are gonna fight this monster. I try to talk to him, joke's on you, it can't talk. I try to read its mind, joke's on you, you go crazy. You know, so there seems like a certain amount of like walling off options, but I don't think it has to be that way. And I'm gonna try and take a more positive attitude toward the Spellweaver in this episode, because if you think about it, this is actually a kind of monster that's very good for me, because I am not going to be able to, it's just not where my interests lie. I'm not going to come up with a monster that's mechanically interesting on my own devices, right? Like, typically what I do is come up with, you know, fun background and motivations to interact and things that it cares about, and then I just copy the stats for a troll or whatever. And, you know, that is a weak point. So looked at from that perspective, a monster that has interesting mechanics, but whose kind of like interactability is a bit of a blank slate should actually be ideal for me, because I can create all that other stuff, right? So what we're going to do is take these mechanics and this kind of core concept, because I think the Spellweaver also has a cool look. They're really interesting alien looking creatures. There's an illustration, which is also by Ed O'Connell in that Dragon Magazine article. And then they were then included in the first Monsters Compendium annual. Maybe the Dragon Magazine article is 89 and the Monsters Compendium annual is 1990. I don't know. But anyway, they were in there. And that's a very nice illustration by Tony DiTerlizzi. So doesn't otherwise add anything to the Dragon article. So they've got a cool look. Like they're neat, the big eyes. They look quite alien. You know, I think there's something there. So first question. How do the PCs meet the Spellweavers? I think there are really two main ways that Spellweavers can be incorporated into an ongoing campaign. And the first way is shenanigans. And if your DM does it, you should laugh them to scorn. I had a thought about the Spellweavers when I read the article. And then, you know, as I was going back over it again, I was talking to my wife, Allison, and she had the exact same reactions. And when I described the Spellweavers, I said, I think their main use is, and she said, a DM who regrets giving the player characters a powerful magic item sends in a team of Spellweavers to steal it. I said, yeah, pretty much. A little bit like the Disenchanter or the Reflector, I think, had something similar like that. The DM is unhappy with the fact that one of the characters now has a sword of wounding or whatever, and decides to use an in-character, in-game method to balance out the situation. This never works. Because of the DM's like control of the game, of the world, there is no way that the DM can quote-unquote play fair, right? There's no... That's just simply not how that relationship works. The DM can be a fair-minded, impartial arbiter of a situation, but they can't play fair because the imbalance of power in terms of the rules is so great. You can come up with a contrived in-world explanation for any piece of DM shenanigans that you want to do, and the players will not be happier if you say, look, hey, these are these monsters. They like to steal magic items, and you point to this article in Dragon Magazine. This returns to a thing that I say frequently, which is there is no such thing as an in-character solution to an out-of-character problem. You know, you gave the players that sword, now you're going to have to cope with the effect that it has in your game, or talk to the players, you know, hey fellas, feel like that sword's a little too powerful. What if we did this instead? Most of the time, I think people are quite reasonable. Anyway, my point is don't use Spellweavers like that. Instead, I think the kind of, and I think the role that they're intended for, Spellweavers, is that they are the rival heist team. In an adventure where the player characters are going into the dungeon to retrieve the blue jewel, there's another team of thieves trying to get the blue jewel, and these guys are Spellweavers. And so it gives you that kind of like sports movie thing where the other team are super good. Like Spellweavers are, they're not evil necessarily, but they're intimidating because they're so powerful and strange. You know, the fact that these guys are so chimped, like, it might feel a little dubious when you read the article, but I think it has the potential, especially if you lay the groundwork to like build up their reputation in advance, that it turns the heist into like a snobs versus slobs story about how you got to get the blue jewel before the snotty rich kids get the blue jewel. So I think that's the ideal role in a campaign for Spellweavers, rival heist team. Having said that, we now need to decide what is the deal with Spellweavers. In a little bit, I'm going to talk about the Paizo variation. So much, much later on, you know, 200 and some odd issues of Dragon Magazine later, there was another article about Spellweavers that gave them a whole background, and indeed gave them like a number of alternate possible elements, which I always think is nice. And it did include some explanations for why they want magic items. And I think we'll talk in more detail about the article in a moment, but I just want to single out the explanation for magic items, which I think is rather, like, it's interesting conceptually, but I don't think it's interesting in play. So according to this, spellweavers, you know, they live a certain length of time, and then they can rejuvenate themselves by breaking down all these magical items into, like, their magical energy and components and building themselves, like, a kind of cocoon, a sort of stasis pod thingy that they get into, and then when they reemerge, they've been rejuvenated. So the spellweavers essentially need large amounts of magic items to build the devices that allow them to live. What that means is they basically can't be negotiated with. This does possibly impose a moral dilemma that the creature needs this device to live, but you need it to save lives or whatever. So maybe there's that element in there. But in general, I find that that's not a very... It's a bit like the explanation that the arcane reproduce using gold. It's a fun concept, but in play it tends to close off opportunities rather than multiply them, because... It's something that, like, it gives the spellweaver, like, it makes sense if the spellweavers were player characters, because it gives them a really powerful motivation to do things overcoming adversity. But with an NPC, what you need are potential motivations that the PCs can use as leverage. Now, there is one little, like, loophole here, which is that, of course, the spellweavers just need magic items, broadly speaking. So let's say that a super powerful spellweaver had stolen the blue jewel, and you go and see it, and you're like, you know, we need the blue jewel, and he says, well, look, I mean, assuming you figure out some way to communicate, look, I need magic items to build my rejuvenation cocoon. And then the PCs say, well, just any magic items? We'll trade you 2 magic items for the blue jewel. And so then they got to go and get some magic items so they can swap. I mean, that could be fun. That's actually a variant of what I'm about to talk about. Because I think we want a motivation that provides opportunities for the PCs to do things, right? If the monster's motivation doesn't prompt some kind of fun interaction or some kind of fun action for the PCs, then what's the point of it? So, alternative one, Crisis on Earth X. So the spellweavers keep, like, stealing Helms of Terror or whatever, and then popping off back to their home plane, which nobody knows where it is. What if they actually need these things for some reason? And what if you could kind of infer that from the things that they're taking? So if you look at the pattern of Spellweaver thefts, maybe it seems like they're stockpiling magic weapons and armor. Uh-oh, that's bad. So it also says in the Dragon article that they have these cool lairs. Some of them are in, like, mutant trees. Some of them are in floating disks that they hide inside of clouds, kind of like UFOs. Very cool. So let's say you go to get the blue jewel, but just as you arrive, you see the spellweavers grabbing it and plane shifting out, and then you follow up rumors of mysterious big-eyed six-armed weirdos in the valley until you finally find their floating ritual platform concealed inside a cloud, and you activate the planar gateway, and you wind up in Spellworld, only to find that the spellweavers are, like, manning the battlements against an invasion of alien war machines or infernal hordes or something, and then, you know, they explain that they're sorry that they took your blue jewel, but they need it and other powerful magical weapons to fight off this invasion their homeworld. You say, well, what if we stood to help you, blah, blah, blah. And so they help the spellweavers defeat their foes, take the blue jewel, and jet off back to the prime material plane with the thanks of a grateful nation. Alternative 1A, the old Beta Ray Bill, suggests that the inhabitants of Spellworld are not themselves spellweavers. The spellweavers are created by these people in order to go to other planes. Like, they're geared up into these kind of, like, elite magical super soldiers, but that most people back in their home plane are more kind of ordinary folks. They're not all six-armed, non-talking, telepathic spell slingers. I call this Beta Ray Bill because, of course, that's the character Beta Ray Bill from The Mighty Thor. Like, his whole deal is that he's this weird super soldier. Like, he's a freakish alien to humans, but he's also a freakish alien to his own species because they don't normally look like that. I mean, there's also nothing wrong with just having them be alien. It's cool. Alternative two, Master Thieves. So maybe the Spellweavers are just this, like, no one knows where they came from, but they're just like a colorful elite thief team. And the reason that you don't see them, like, coming back to use the magic items is that they are not keeping them, right? They've been tasked to steal them by somebody else, either because they're just like a colorful group of thieves for hire, or because they're some kind of creation of some evil wizard, right? He needed to get all these magical items, and so he created these master magical item go-getters. And you know, this is kind of like when you have the conspiramid, that's a term from the role-playing game Knights Black Agents, but when you're kind of outlining the steps, you know, down at the bottom you have sort of your rank and file enemy troopers, your goons and your guards, and then as you go up, you start to get to these kind of like named henchmen, each with sort of a gimmick. You set out to topple M. Bison. You've got, you know, legions of red-jacketed Shadaloo troopers, and then you've got like some elite kind of enemy soldiers, right? You've got the Dolls, and then you've got Vega, Balrog, and either Sagat or Fong, depending. And then you've got Bison himself, so maybe like they're in that kind of like colorful henchman role. I just used a Street Fighter analog when I could have used the James Bond analog. This tells you something about my cultural framework. It's like Odd Job, right? Like you have a bunch of trooper goons, and then you have some colorful goons, and they could be colorful goons. That'd be fine too. I like Master Thief as a colorful goon. Let's look at alternative 3, the Paizo variation. So Dragon Magazine number 388 expands on the background of the Spellweavers in an article by Tito Leite, illustrated by Peter Burling and Jeff Carlisle with Tito Leite. And if it's Laiti or Laiti, then I apologize. So this is from 2005, which I think of as recent, even though it was 16 years ago. And in this, we learn that the Spellweavers are that old favorite, the last remnants of an interdimensional empire. So this big, like, multiplanar empire left settlements called nodes, which are like these big pyramids on lots of different planes, but often just one node per plane, which is an idea that I really like, because at low level you could have the PCs explore a dungeon that was, you know, a Spellweaver node, a big arcane pyramid once inhabited by an empire of sorcerer kings with like a big crystal at the top and all that good kind of science fantasy jazz. And then they would just be like, oh yeah, that was that one dungeon that we went to, right? Different dungeons of different themes. And then much later on when they're higher level and they're like hopping around the planes, they run into another one. That's kind of a neat little payoff. I like that. This is the article I mentioned earlier that says they need magic items to extend their lives, but which I didn't really think was as good as it might be, but there are a few fun ideas in here. Actually, it's just like a lot of later D&D stuff. I feel like it sometimes takes a long time to say all these good things, but anyway, so a couple of points that it introduces. First, I love this idea they can speak, but they just don't. That, you know, they have their own language, but they don't talk. And they did this kind of almost like a monastic vow of silence. It was intended to help them develop their telepathic ability. So they weren't originally all that telepathic, and then they just kind of improved it by abandoning speech. They're also kind of obsessed with language and meaning. They're sort of like a race of semiotician wizards, which I think is fun. And that ties in neatly to the idea that they don't speak. You know, they're so interested in utterance that they actually don't talk, but also they can convey information very fast because A, they're telepathic, and B, they got six hands all sign languaging at you at the same time. So they're actually extremely efficient data communicators, although presumably, you know, you would have to master their sign language, which could be quite tricky since you don't have six hands. And they were sort of trying, one of the alternatives that's presented is that they were trying to discover the language that gods use to shape the cosmos. And that has a very Unknown Armies-y feel to me, not the thing about the language that gods use to shape the cosmos, although I'm sure that's in Unknown Armies, but like that's a pretty common theme. You know, the idea that there is a magical language whose utterances are reality, that's what they were trying to uncover. But I do, it's very Unknown Armies-y that in order to master the divine speech, you have to not talk. That kind of opposition is something that's a big feature of that game. Anyway, they inherit the memories of their forebears, which I like. So when Spellweavers die, they divide into six, through another ritual, they can divide into six new Spellweavers, each of whom inherits the memories of their parent. And I think the idea is that they sort of collectively inherit or can quickly absorb the memories of other Spellweavers. And they have quite like divided views on whether they should try to restore this fallen multiplanar empire, right? Because there's the legend that out there is this magical formula that they designed before the big experiment that exploded them that essentially would allow them to like load the save and bring their empire back. And some of them think this is a really good idea, and some of them think it would be a good idea, but it's a pipe dream, you know, like it's just a legend, or it was destroyed. And there are some who think, you know, what is, and we should just like adapt to our new life as like wandering outcasts and magical mercenaries and not try to rewrite history. That's fun. And there are some nice illustrations. You know, I don't think they're as cool as the Deterlitzy one, the actual illustration of the Spellweavers, but I do like the kind of contextual illustrations showing like an antiquarian studying the ancient runes of the Spellweavers. There's some cool like Spellweaver art. The idea that this node is like an archaeological site that he's trying to figure out the puzzle of. And maybe the, you know, whatever secret magic they uncovered, like there might be Spellweavers that were trying to get it so that they could help restore their empire. And there might be Spellweavers who were trying to get, you know, to stop the antiquarian so that they wouldn't unleash the same cataclysm that destroyed the Spellweaver Empire. I think those are both pretty good, right? I do like the idea, obviously, given my background, of dungeon exploration as archaeological expedition. There's a bit in here that I'm not so sure about how they gave magic weapons to primitive humanoids in order to aid in their destruction. Like, they wanted to make sure that humanoids that, like, they encountered never got so, like, civilized and powerful that they could overcome the Spellweavers. But it just seems that, like, in general, the idea is that there are not very many Spellweavers, and although they're magically potent, they're kind of weenies physically, which is not consistent with them having 300 hit points, but never mind. It is third, so 300 points don't go as far as it used to. And I would say that this isn't a theory with holes in it. This is more hole than theory, right? If you've got magic powers and the primitive humanoids have like numbers and physical strength, but they have sticks and rocks, I don't know that you're going to bring their civilization to ruins by giving them, you know, swords of wounding and bags of holding and stuff. But I do like the idea that they are this kind of like relatively small group of kind of detached philosopher wizards who, you know, were worried about, you know, these humans don't like reproduce once every 3,600 years like a Spellweaver does. So they're worried about being outnumbered. Anyway, I think you can fit the collapsed empire in with the Master Thieves pretty easily, right? Like maybe the Master Thieves are among that group who are like happy with the collapse of the empire. We're not happy with it, but resigned to it, and are just out there trying to make a living being master magic item thieves. Maybe one of them still secretly longs to find the anti-time equation or whatever, and, you know, is sort of using the master thief bit as a cover. Mind you, they could use the master thief bit as a cover in general, right? They're little looking for these like ancient artifacts that contain the formula. So, you know, getting hired on as artifact thieves seems like a good way to go about it. Maybe that extraplanar citadel is like the last node, right? It's the node that didn't participate in their big empire-destroying experiment. That could be kind of cool. I'm proposed to take a magpie approach to this article and just kind of like take some bits out of it that I like. But the concept, I think, is one that I might recycle. So actually, as usual, I kind of talked myself into liking the Spellweavers. I will say they've got a beautiful design. It's a very cool image. They're very obviously not from the D&D fantasy milieu, which I think is always cool as long as you kind of keep it to a, you know, you only use it every day. It's quite a strong spice. So, but in certain adventures, I think it works. And I think that there's a couple of different ways that you could use them, especially in a higher level game, to provide interesting rivals, maybe, rather than antagonists. And that's always a fun role to fill in a game. I like rival adventuring parties, and as you get to high levels, it's nice when they're like weird extraplanar alien master thieves. So that's about all the time that we have to talk about Spellweavers today. Gerald, thank you very much for your support once again, and I hope that you enjoyed the episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Gerald and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition, and we'll be revisiting some monsters that we've seen before and seeing which of them have got a makeover and which of them have been turned into swamp fascists by the new edition. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.